everyone. Welcome to Horrorspiria. My name is May, and today we are doing a special pod with one of my favorite people. She's one of my colleagues. I've learned a lot from her, and today we're kind of going to be talking about film business in a sense of like going through certain terms that are unfamiliar to people, just kind of, you know, learn more about the business of film. You know, this is a genre film podcast, but you all know that I'm also a film academic, and being cognizant of these terms, I feel, makes us better movie watchers, movie writers. And also, if some of you are listening to this and eventually want to go make your own films, you know, these are really important terms to know for yourself, especially when you get into signing deals with studios or distributors. But before we get into it, let me introduce Lisa Thrasher. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good. So go ahead and tell the people who you are in your own words.
My name's Lisa Thrasher, as you stated, and I'm a film producer. And just to make sure that I'm keeping everybody up and current with everything, a film producer, for those of you who don't know, is basically the boss of a film. So each film is constructed, and the power dynamics are a little bit different depending on who owns the film, who brought the project along, who wrote it, and all of those sorts of things. But if I'm just going to speak kind of generally, a film producer is somebody who usually finds a project, finds an idea, or finds a either a writer or a director that they like to work with, and the producer says, okay, let's make a movie. And they work with the writer or the director or both to develop the idea. Sometimes the idea comes from the producer themselves, and sometimes it comes from somebody else. It can come in a bunch of different ways. And then the producer shepherds the idea and the script creatively. And the producer is very heavily involved in the creative aspect of giving notes and restructuring the story to make sure that it is meeting the needs of the film creatively, but that it's also meeting needs of the market business-wise, and that the story is told within the budget scope that they are aiming for, which is dependent on who's paying for it, and all of those sorts of things.
And you've done quite a few different productions of varying budget sizes, right?
Most of my stuff has been low budget, ultra low budget. My features have been ultra low budget. Percentage wise, I've probably spent more on the shorts that I've produced. I've spent more cash making the shorts proportionally than I have spent cash making the features, which makes it really hard. You know, most of my work is queer. And so a lot of times it's hard to find distribution for queer product, and sometimes it's hard to find financing for queer product. So I always kind of approach these pieces as they're necessary. They're necessary for our queer community. They're also necessary for the world. And I really, I guess I saw Christine Vachon described as an auteur producer. And it kind of clicked for me at that moment. I don't pretend to assume that I'm an auteur producer yet, but I think that I would like to one day, hopefully, be viewed as that kind of producer who really takes really highly creative stories, works with really visionary directors and writers to create a project that is different and fresh and tells a unique story from a unique perspective. And, you know, oftentimes those stories from those perspectives are time-based too. So sometimes when you go back and look at even some of one's own work, you might be like, oh, wow, I didn't realize how marked in time that was. And so that's another thing a producer should think about, is the life of the film and how the issues talked about in the film may mark it or have it viewed differently.
You know, I really like what you said about the auteur producer, because actually, right before we started this, I like listening to podcasts myself, and I was listening to an interview with the producers from Black Bear, which is an independent film that was released this year, but they received an EMA Green Seal, which EMA, Environmental Media Association, and so I was listening to a talk from the head of the Environmental Media Association, and they were like, you know, producers run sort of the film world, but they usually get the least amount of recognition, you know, despite the fact that they're the ones organizing everything, you know, and like the whole EMA's goal is to like give monetary value to that and recognize producers that are being innovative, specifically with them on how to make sets green and environmentally friendly and things like that. And so I really like that idea, because I myself, when I wanted to get into the industry, I wanted to be a producer, but I was not patient. You need to have a lot of patience and a lot of faith in other people. And those are two
things. A lot of patience with people too. It's not always easy.
Yeah, not my strength. So I've always admired that about you. But you also, right now you're a film producer, but another thing that always fascinates me about you is you were also a lawyer for quite a long time, right?
I worked for 5 years for 20th Century Fox, and I did international anti-piracy litigation and trademark prosecution.
Yeah, so you have quite, like you've seen almost every aspect of how this industry works, which is pretty crazy. Cool, yeah. So essentially today we just kind of want to go over some thoughts. I've been working on this Amazon Studios piece that will be going public soon. And going through that process, I just came across a lot of really weird situations and terms that I wasn't really familiar with. And so I just want to go over some of those and talk about things in a general sense. So maybe a softball question to start. What do you think, like, what is the difference between, say, a production company and a film studio?
So the kind of easy answer is a film studio has everything in-house. So let's say a film studio wanted to develop a film, shoot a film, go through post-production, and then distribute it themselves. Film studios are a family of companies that all come together under a parent company, and they have the sub companies or the sister companies doing each one of those aspects of development, production, post, and distribution. They can do the marketing in-house. They usually have a costume department on the lot. And so a studio really has everything in-house, whereas a production company, depending on the company itself, of course, I could have a little small production company, Thrasher Films, that could be just me and I'm just doing my producing work out of it. Or you could have a large company like Lionsgate that is referred to in the industry as a mini major, because it's not a studio, but it's getting very close.
Right. That's really interesting to think about. So technically, I mean, you could be one person and be a production company. And if that's the case, you're doing producerial duties at large. Yeah. And instead the studios, so like studios wouldn't really outsource anything, right? Or would they?
No, they do. So the way that the studios generally run things is they want to make a movie. They figure out what the idea is, the script, just like I explained kind of in the intro about producing. So they do that. That's usually done through their development department and legal department that would secure those deals and stuff is called business affairs. Legal affairs is where I worked, which was litigation. Business affairs is the department, the legal department in the studio that does all the contracts and all the deals for the films. And there are different, you know, different lawyers do different types of things and specialize in different areas. So the, you know, a studio would have multiple legal departments. Like there'd be a legal department for employment issues. There'd be a legal department for maybe press issues or something like that. There would be another legal department for licensing and merchandising. So when I was working for 20th Century Fox, of course, The Simpsons is one of 20th Century Fox's properties. So we would, I did an internship when I was in law school in the licensing and merchandising department at 20th Century Fox. And so I would draft their contracts for their deals. They would license Simpsons characters and the Simpsons name for like potato chips in the UK or Reese's Pieces or something like that, or toys or t-shirts, posters, all kinds of things. So the way that they monetize their properties, their franchises, like, you know, Die Hard or Alien, the Alien series, or The Simpsons, is they're really wringing as much money out of that as they possibly can. Because they're also very expensive properties to maintain franchises.
Right. You know, I think probably where my question comes from, and I'll go ahead and use Amazon Studios as an example. So when Amazon Studios started out in 2010, it was announced as at first a website where people could submit stuff and get feedback. But along with the announcement, Amazon Studios said that they were going to be signing a first look deal with Warner Brothers. Now, explain what that kind of means. Like, what's a first look deal? And like, what do you think probably, what did that mean?
So Amazon, when it was starting out, did not have the infrastructure for full-blown distribution.
They seem, at least in my opinion, it seems like they were maybe a production company per se, right?
They made the decision, we want to be a production company, but they would like to grow it into a studio. So they did the right thing and named themselves Amazon Studios because they want to secure that trademark and start branding themselves. And then they can start building the company up and get to where they want to go. So a first look deal would probably in that scenario is more of an output deal or a first look output deal, meaning that any films that Amazon Studios either made or acquired, purchased after the film was made, if they're in a first look deal, that means they have to go to Warner Brothers first and say, here's our slate of films that we have. We want, you know, will you distribute any of these and what are you going to give us? And so a first look deal would mean that Amazon has to take their movies to Warner Brothers studio. Warner Brothers then has probably a set period of time within which they can decide, yes, we want to distribute this or no, we don't. If they say yes, a first look deal probably obligates Amazon to go with it. So if Warner Brothers says, yes, we will distribute The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, for example, which is one of their properties, then Amazon probably could not say no. That's probably within the structure of the first look deal that they have established.
So that's interesting.
And then if they say no to a property, then Amazon would have the ability to go out and shop it to any of the other studios for distribution or to the independent distribution companies.
So that's interesting. So in that context, it seems like a first look deal is kind of like almost like a Big Brother thing. Like, we'll help you out if we like it. And if we like it, then you must distribute it. But if we don't like it, so it's not like if Warner Brothers said no, Amazon was forbidden from making it. It was just a matter of they had to then go make another deal.
Right. A first look deal basically means anything that Amazon makes during the term of that contract, Amazon has to take to Warner Brothers first. Warner Brothers has the right of first refusal to take which properties they want. And when once they, I've been watching a lot of period pieces. I almost said whence. Whence they don't take it.
You're so funny.
Then if Warner Brothers says, no, we don't want to take that, then Amazon can go and shop it just like any other independent film would do and try and find distribution elsewhere. Now, Amazon is in a different position because they do have a platform for streaming distribution. But streaming distribution does not make as much money as is needed to recoup the money for the film.
It's interesting that you said that too. Yeah, because one thing that tends to set Amazon apart is the fact that from the beginning they wanted theatrical windows. Whereas when Netflix began to announce, I haven't done as much research into Netflix, so I don't know if they really signed first look deals, but it may sound like maybe they didn't because they didn't want the theatrical distribution. They were very much set on everything being streaming only. And I think maybe even you might have told me in the past, or maybe I read this somewhere else, where especially with Netflix, you're like paid a lump sum for your property and then you don't see royalties again. That's all of Netflix's business, right?
That's correct, at least as far as I understand it from smaller properties. Now, if Netflix was doing a deal with somebody much bigger than me, for example, like
let's say Kevin Hart, I think they have a deal with Kevin Hart.
Okay, so Kevin Hart, Kevin may have negotiated something different, and that's an aspect of distribution and the business of film and television that I should probably mention here before we go too much further, is every single deal could be its own unique beast.
Right.
So yeah, there is kind of a standard way that things are done, but depending on people's cachet, depending on their name value and their ability just for their name to sell a property or a film or to get, you know, to market a film on it, their deal may be very different than the standard deal with smaller, newer, greener filmmakers who don't have the heft yet to be able right. to say, no, we're doing it my way.
Right. That makes sense. So I have a question. Are first look deals more common, I guess, in higher budget situations, or do first look deals still happen in like a low budget sense?
No, first look deals would not really happen in a low budget sense. It would just primarily be with bigger people. So if you think about it, pretend for a moment, because we oftentimes don't put ourselves in the shoes of Amazon, but pretend for a moment that you're Amazon and you're having to make decisions about your money. Are you necessarily going to do a first look kind of output deal with somebody who's not established, who you don't know can deliver a creative piece that will actually sell? So you would make those investments, like Netflix has made deals with Shonda Rhimes and Ryan Murphy. And so you see that Netflix is making these kind of deals with really big names who have a very proven track record of success, critical success to a certain level for sure, but probably more so a financial success.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense. So before we get further into like what happens between partnering and other things. Another term that I would often see that I'm not too sure about are spec deals. Do you mind explaining what a spec deal is?
I'm not even 100% sure what a spec deal was. When I read your Amazon paper, I was like, what's a spec deal?
Let me build context. And that's, so Amazon Studios did start off that literally anyone could go to studios.amazon.com, submit their screenplay. And there was a department within Amazon Studios that would read these things. And apparently Amazon's first, and they build it, they said it was a spec deal. The first feature film script that they bought was just someone's random script that was submitted, and they gave that person what they called a spec deal. And I was like, what does that even mean? So that's the context there.
So generally, when you're talking about, generally the term spec in the industry is attached to a spec script. So a spec script is, let's say you want to get hired as a writer, you would, and you want to get hired on the show Grey's Anatomy, for example, just to use one of Shonda Rhimes's shows. You would write an episode of Grey's Anatomy in the voice with the storyline that is current, and you would show them that you can fit into their model. So I would imagine, if I'm going to guess, which I need to guess because I'm not 100% sure, I would guess that it would be they're asking for kind of spec scripts. I really don't know, to be
That's
honest.
So interesting.
I'm so curious.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, that's
because it doesn't make sense that Amazon would take scripts from unknown people just submitting four properties if they aren't actually running properties yet.
Yeah. And they also gave the guy a manager and an agent within the same deal, which I also thought was, it was just one of those things where I was like, does this even happen often? Because it just seems like they took a chance on someone.
It does. It happens all the time, but usually somebody needs to have something to show.
Right.
They usually need to have a film. So what they may be doing is kind of an output deal or a like a 3-year deal, for example. So sometimes the studios, if somebody had a big film that was a big hit, even if it was an indie big hit that got picked up by a studio, the studio may pick up their script, and what might be negotiated in there is that the studio would give them a 3-year first look deal. So what happens sometimes is they'll set them up with an office and staff and money inside the studio, and they will pay them a salary and everything else for 3 years. And during that time, that writer director will write a bunch of scripts, and then they are obligated, just like we were talking about Amazon and Warner Brothers, they would be obligated, that writer director or producer would be obligated to bring the property to the studio first, and the studio would have the right of first refusal to actually pick it up and make it or to reject it, and then they could go elsewhere.
Very interesting. So I guess now let's kind of get into the mind frame of how companies, I guess, become film studios, right? So one thing that I noticed is that, you know, a company will get into producing, but they can't distribute yet, which I guess kind of makes sense because especially with distributing, you need to have relationships and whatnot. And so to keep using, I guess, Amazon as a case study, they partnered with indie distributors very early on, like Roadside Attractions and Bleecker Street. And I thought that that was interesting because indie distributors, I guess, and from my perspective, and please correct me if I'm wrong, seem to have, I guess, like less opportunities per se. And so it makes me curious as to why you may think that they didn't go for larger distributors at first? Or is that something that you think they had to work up to? Or how does that work when, like, there's a production company and they want to distribute? So, like, how would they go about doing that?
So they probably entered into distribution deals or an output deal with Roadside Attractions or Bleecker Street. And they probably wanted to do it through an independent distributor because they didn't want to be eclipsed by the studios. They're trying to build into a studio. They're not quite there yet, but they are doing a lot of really good content. They're getting there. But I mean, most of the studios were established in the 20s.
Right.
And they've kind of been building up their brand and building their process and building their lot and everything else for almost 100 years, I guess, now. Not quite, but around there. So it makes sense. I mean, Roadside Attractions and Bleecker Street are both very well respected, very viable players in the distribution world. And an independent filmmaker would be thrilled to get a deal with Roadside Attractions or Bleecker Street. They're both really good indie distribution companies. And I had mentioned something earlier about not having the infrastructure for distribution. And what I mean by that is, if you are going to do a theatrical distribution, you've got to take those film prints from city to city to city to city. And although they're probably doing a lot of distribution on drives now, whereas they were not necessarily doing that in the early 2000s, most films were still distributed on film prints. And so distribution is very strongly limited by piracy. So the whole kind of theory behind distribution is to distribute your film in the way that you can monetize its exhibition for as much money as you can to recoup your costs and hopefully make a profit within the order that will create the least piracy. And as you open it up, you've kind of wrung the most money out of it that you can. So a theatrical distribution, for the most part, is going to be the least easy to pirate. I mean, sure, people might sit in a theater and do a cell phone video of the movie and stuff like that, but those kinds of things can generally be caught. And I've noticed that a lot of theaters, you can't even get reception inside them, which I believe is probably intentional. They probably protect the theaters in a way so that the whether or not they are receiving the films digitally cannot be interrupted and decrypted, but also so people can't film them on their cell phones when they're in there. So theatrical distribution is a great marketing tool, first of all. In the old days, before streaming became so popular and so widespread, the real bread and butter of distribution was DVD, and before that, VHS tape or, you know, videotape. And that was where the most money was made in distribution. But as streaming becomes more popular with the consumer, and consumers are pulling back from the home entertainment format, such as DVD, VHS, or the discs, the laser discs or whatever, the studios and everybody in the industry are scrambling, trying to figure out, how are we going to monetize these films, which are costing us millions of dollars to make? How on earth are we going to make the money back from that?
Right. I think you brought up so many great points. And I think the first point I want to touch on actually brings us back to the forward. So we'll kind of get back to Amazon as a case study. But I wanted your opinion as to what you think this HBO Max controversy is like. Because, we won't get into deep details with it, but obviously Warner Brothers decided that they're doing this whole streaming to theatrical day release strategy for all of their releases next year. They just did it with Wonder Woman 1984 on Christmas. And, you know, a couple of things that I've really taken from all of this, you know, obviously the filmmakers are really upset. A lot of that, I know has to deal with a lot of their back-end deals, which back-end deals really quick, you know, especially for larger franchises, usually above the line, people make a certain percentage of box office revenue for really big properties. But, you know, I personally think that it's a good thing because I especially know a lot of people that have accessibility issues or can't go to the movie theaters. I grew up in poverty. I wasn't able to ever go to the movie theater, and something like this would have changed how I viewed films. But, you know, there's also like this other criticism of, you know, we're sort of the film industry at large, the mainstream film industry has kind of killed, you know, low budget and mid budget movies. So that right now, like the ones that usually make the most money are these really high budget films, but now those films aren't probably going to make back the money that they make. So, you know, that's another point to talk about. But I think what is most interesting, and it also kind of has to do with the Amazon thing, is when I was doing a lot of my research, a lot of people thought that Amazon's theatrical push was actually a mistake because the videos would end up on Prime a month later. And so a lot of opinions I would see would be like, I didn't want to go see it in a theater. I just waited for it to come on Prime. And that's why Amazon in the last few years has even been shifting away from the theatrical distribution. But I was just wondering if you thought that perhaps that really this whole streaming to theatrical release day of is a sign for something, or do you think it's just a solution for the short term?
It's definitely a solution for the short term because of COVID, for sure.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't do that, then, I mean, how long are they going to hold these films before they do a theatrical release? And with the big franchise properties, people are going to still see those in the theater. So let's say COVID is gone and everything is kind of back to hopefully a better normal. And they may do a release in the summer, and there may be a ton of people that will go see Wonder Woman in a theatrical release, although I've heard a couple of
this
customers.
It was terrible. And I loved the first one, but this second one was a mess. No, but I actually agree, because not only does it kind of upset me that people don't realize this whole accessibility angle, but if I had the choice to go see Wonder Woman in theaters and it was safe, and if I were to have seen it at home, I would have seen it in theaters, because yeah. I like going to movie theaters. And while I always find it really difficult to sympathize with directors that make millions of dollars on big budget movies, like Christopher Nolan and Denis Villeneuve, I think is how he says his name. You know, their bitch fits have just been feeding my dark soul. But like, you know, I think it's also such an extreme that people are like, oh, movies are going to go the way of art houses. And I'm like, even if that's true, like what, like suddenly no one wants to go to a movie theater again? I'm sorry. I don't buy it.
I know everybody keeps talking about that during COVID. Everybody's like, this is the death of the movie theater. And every, you know, it's like Chicken Little, like the sky is falling. I don't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. Completely wrong.
Yeah.
But people love going to the movie theaters, and especially now that we've been trapped at home for almost a year.
Yeah.
We want to get out.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
And even what I noticed, even when I would go and attend the screenings of my films at film festivals and stuff like that, the audience affects the way you feel about the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're in the theater and the audience is excited and everybody's loving it, the collective, I sound very like California.
No, I'm here with you.
The collective energy of people and the electricity of everybody's excitement. It's catching. We don't often really talk about this or tap into this, and probably I didn't expect to in a discussion about distribution of all things, but you know, people have energy and we feed off each other's energy. And I think that during COVID, we've all realized that a lack of energy from others is really detrimental to all of us. So even sitting in a movie theater, even if you're there by yourself and you're laughing and somebody else is laughing, or you're screaming and somebody else is screaming, it makes it more fun.
Yeah, I do hope that drive-in theaters, like proper drive-in theaters, do make more of a comeback, because there's not really one that's that great in the DMV area. But in back in Orlando, actually, we have a drive-in theater that has been open since the 40s, and they have pretty much kept it exactly the same. And whenever I wanted to see a movie, that was always my first choice. And in South Florida too, there's a really big one in a flea market. But yeah, drive-in theaters need to make a comeback. And also, you know, I worry more about the indie movie theaters that were already in danger. But I also have, I think it's, if anything, I feel like the most creative problem solving with theatrical distributions have come from places like Sun Cinema in DC. There's also another one, I think the Parkway in Baltimore, but them doing independent releases that you have to buy online to access, like, I feel like that's really smart as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so to kind of pivot back to Amazon, and this is kind of like one of my final questions. So over the years, and especially I think as of 2018, Amazon considers itself a film studio. They handle all of their distribution. But one thing that I noticed a lot as I saw how their credits evolved is, especially in the beginning, like when they bought The Wall in 2014 with the spec deal, and when they bought Chirac from Spike Lee, which was their first movie, they were listed as a production company for a lot of those early releases. And then as I tracked more of their press releases, I noticed that they would, like in press releases, they would say that they're financing the film, but then in the credits, I would only see them listed as a distributor. Now, I know that you explained this to me in a very specific way, that doesn't mean that they're not producing it. So I just wondered if you could go into detail about what does it mean when, like, something is co-financed, but perhaps they're not credited a certain way.
Well, again, it depends on the deal. And without us actually being able to see the contracts themselves, which all those contractual deals are private. Right. So without actually being able to see the contract, I can't give you the exact answer for Spike Lee's film or any other film in particular. However, so there are different ways that co-productions work. So sometimes a studio or film production company you'll pitch your movie to them and they'll love it and they'll say, okay, we're going to buy it and we are going to give you a letter that says we are going to pick it up, but you're going to make it. So we're going to pick it up. We're going to buy it from you from $10 million. You said that you need $8 million to make the movie. So you're making a $2 million profit. And that's the deal. So the way that I have heard that Netflix is doing this, for example, is they will make those kind of deals and they'll give you an option of one or two directions. They'll run it through their own line producer who will come up with what they think the budget is. And they will either produce it, meaning that they use one of their production companies that they work with on a regular basis. They know how those production companies work, and that production company runs it. And the like writer, director, and producer, for example, if they're the ones selling it, they would get the money, they would still be there, but they wouldn't be, their company wouldn't be producing per se. Or they'll give you the letter saying they're going to buy it for $10 million. You take the letter, you go to the bank loans you the $10 million. You go make the movie, you finish the movie, you bring it back, you deliver it to them. It goes through their quality control. It's all QC'd. Once everything is signed off on, including contracts and everything else, then they will take the movie. They'll give you a check for the $10 million. You take that to the bank.
I think what you described is probably exactly what they do, because when I was beginning research on this, because of the credits, I first went through all the credits. I thought that Amazon didn't produce any of their shows because they're not listed as a production company. But I actually had a friend who just worked on the Underground Railroad with Barry Jenkins. And when I said this to them, they were like, no, that's not true. Because when I was on the Underground Railroad set, they're trucks were everywhere. So they had people on set. And so I think that that's really interesting, especially because, you know, it seems like Jeff Bezos' whole desire with Amazon Studios is really the prestige. You know, he's the one that really is trying to gun for these Oscars, but it's not like distributors win Oscars, right? Production companies do. So I assume they must be doing something very similar to that.
You might also see in the credits some of their in-house staff, like their development department head or something like that, maybe getting an executive producer credit on there, which says to me that they were involved at the development stage or at the pre-production and development stage. And so they were producing in a way, but they're not like a producer like me. The head of development at Amazon is not going to be on the set every day running around making sure all the water bottles that are not meeting environmental standards are picked up.
Now you're trying to get the EMA green seal. That's going to be your next goal.
Yeah.
I think for the most part that covered a lot of my questions, though. I just wanted a bit more information on these little terms and nitpicking between things. I'm sure you get this question a lot, so I'm going to ask you anyway, but especially as a low budget producer, what do you feel like is the most business savvy advice a filmmaker can have, especially as they're trying to make their low budget film? You know, they're trying to make the smart moves business wise, because usually that's where these things fail, right? We're creative people. We're not necessarily these business masterminds. What do you think, especially in a 2020, 2021 context, what are the things that business wise we really should be mindful of?
So I think that sometimes green filmmakers actually do what I think is the antithesis of what they should do. They spend too much time worrying about the business aspect.
Interesting.
And you have to know how the business side works. You need to know within reason what to expect and what to anticipate. Indie films, you're not going to get a million, you know, millions of dollar buyout unless you're an overnight hit, which is possible, but it's not going to happen with every film. So I think a lot of times beginning filmmakers or emerging filmmakers, they think to themselves, oh, I've heard horror sells really well and you can make it for really cheap. And so they're doing horror for the wrong reason, not because they love it and this is a burning story they must tell, but they're doing it for a business reason. And so then they're making the creative subservient to the business interests. And that's no way to make art. So I think, yes, you can make horror, which is a very marketable and viable business adventure, but you really need to make it fresh, or you need to just maybe go all out on business. But sometimes I think, I don't know, you need to maybe tip the seesaw in a little bit different direction.
Sometimes it seems like the smartest business advice is to make sure that you believe in your product, because if you believe in its power, then you can almost make anything marketable. But if you don't, if you're just saying, well, it's marketable, then is it really marketable?
Right. And I mean, you're not going to go to a studio and say it's marketable. Like, who knows what's marketable more than the studio?
Right.
Like, they know what's marketable. They don't need you to tell them that it's marketable. Or they know what they can market. I'm not saying that everything is uniform in what is marketable and what is not marketable. But I think it's also important to note here that distributors have a particular genre that they distribute as well, and an area they've dug their path, and they have their inroads built in a certain way. So you may not take a big franchise fit style film to a Bleecker Street, like Bleecker Street or Roadside Attractions. They're usually picking up art house films. Or films for awards. That's their niche, is award type films and films that are fresh or different stories. So I kind of lost track of where I was going with this.
No, that was good. No, I like that a lot. Because I, like the film I was listening to about Black Bear, it's almost impossible for me to describe to you what that movie's about, but I also saw how like something that small found the right production company, who found the right distributors, who also decided to do this like creative producing in a sustainable way kind of thing, and it worked for them. You know, they're not going to make millions of dollars at the, or maybe they, I don't know how business works, but you know, it's not going to be this huge smash, but it's doing better than they expected because they stuck to the ethos of the film. And I think especially as I grow older and I learned more from my mistakes as a filmmaker, and I want to see students, you know, excel, I feel like telling them to just really find the ideas that they believe in, that way they can push it to people in innovative and realistic ways, is probably the best advice we can give them.
Indeed. And it's also just from a practical perspective. Remember, you're going to be working on a film, especially a feature. You're going to be working on that film or with that film for at least 3 years.
Yeah.
Usually a year of development, usually a year of production and post, usually at least 1 year of film festival distribution, if it's a film festival type film. And then at least a year or so where you need to kind of be still tethered to oversee the distribution, help make marketing decisions and that sort of thing. So if you're not getting in on a film that you are really excited about, it's going to be hard for you to birth that baby.
Absolutely.
For that, you know, for a 3 to 5 year time. It's a lot.
Final question, and I think this is kind of a funny one. Would you tell students to submit to Sundance?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yes, 100%.
Explain.
I come from, I like to make all my decisions from a point of, what if money wasn't an issue? What would I do? And if you don't try for Sundance, you're not going to get in. So it's really hard. I've had films that I thought were amazing films that didn't get in. And I've had 4 shorts that have been in Sundance, which I did think were amazing films and should be in also. But you just never know. I mean, Sundance takes in, if we're just talking about shorts, Sundance takes about 14,000 submissions a year, and they screen anywhere from 60 or 70 to 90 at most short films. So you're in competition with the best filmmakers from all around the world. You got to try.
I love that.
Try. You got to fight optimistic.
All right. Well, I think that is all of our time for today. Thank you so much, Miss Lisa.
It is always thank you. It was wonderful really fun
to talk to you. And yeah, that's it for today. Bye, everyone.
Bye.